I call the meeting of the Environment, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. A quorum is present. Let's start with approval of the minutes. Representative Jordan, have you reviewed the minutes from our last meeting?
Madam Chair, I have reviewed the minutes from March 18th of 2025, and I would move their approval.
Representative Jordan moves the minutes from March 18th, 2025. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. We have quite the agenda today, so we are going to begin. We have Representative Bierman up at the dais with his presenters. We are trying to get through quite a lot, so we're hoping that this bill takes us to about 1:25 p.m. today, and I will move House File 2034 to be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill and turn it over to Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, for hearing the budget requests for the Minnesota Zoo. It's House File 2034, as you mentioned. Before we begin, though, we do have some visitors we would like to just get out and introduce to the committee, please.
Please introduce yourself and your assistant for the committee, please.
She is a full-grown armadillo, and an older armadillo, fully grown at this size, well, the size of a cantaloupe, weighs about as much as a cantaloupe, and I tell you what, next time you go to the grocery store, pick up a cantaloupe and feel the back of it, that's what her scales and bony plates feel like there. But what she's showing is what's special about her, is that this is the only type of armadillo, the three-banded, this little band that grows across here, is the kind that can actually roll up in a ball like this and completely close itself up. Look at this. Talk about cool biomimicry. Head goes right in here, tail goes in the other part, and can completely protect its fragile body on the underside where it doesn't have that built-in armor. So really neat animal. What's our messaging? You know, this animal is wonderful at doing insect control where it lives in South America. And we connect that right back here in Minnesota, all of our wonderful animals that also help to balance out keeping the field invertebrates under control, nature's balancing that right there. And that's what this armadillo does. So let's see. You might have to lean forward in your chairs a little bit, but we can't walk away without seeing what she actually looks like when she's on the ground, because that's really where she's made. She has these cool four legs for walking. Her front legs are actually with these really cool claws that come together, three claws there, and she walks literally on her toenails, not on her tiptoes, but on her toenails. Those are some nice, thick claws that help her to kind of dig into the ground. Head always down into there to figure out, hey, what is this? Is this my habitat? Something else here. If there's danger, what do you think they do? Boom, roll up in that ball. Great self-protection for them. But here she's just enjoying all the different smells, just like when you come to visit us at the zoo. Gotta enjoy all the different smells here too, right? So she's doing the same thing here, right? You might notice there's some hair on her, and that hair tells you she's a mammal, just like you and I are. So it's a good insulator as well for her, even though where she lives is pretty tropical. Very fun. All right, I'm gonna let her smell, but maybe now I'm also gonna get her right back up so you can kind of see that cute little face. Large ears, and look at that nose going. Hello, good afternoon. Actually, it's morning for her, but we're on Zoom time, so good morning. And I'll take any questions if anybody has any questions about our armadillo. Yes. And you know, that's a great question. They do not roll. They roll up in this ball, and that's about it, right, for protection, but to get anywhere from one point to the next point, they're going to be walking on those four legs. Great
What's her name?
This one is Artemis.
Artemis.
So you call her Armadillo 13911, just so you know. She has a number that comes in with her that's specific just to her, so we can look back and do all of her records in that way. But yes, we give her names. Artemis is her name that we have here. She also go out and meet some of our friends in hospitals. So she's a great animal, as you can tell. Really kind of full of some personality, especially when she gets going on that ground. We'll visit when we go out to visit hospitals. Great way to meet these animals when you can't come to the zoo, as well as when we go to disability programs for those that can't make it into the zoo as well. She's one of their favorites. And Donnie, my co-worker, has another fun animal that also makes its rounds. Outreach and as well in our shows. So next time you come to the zoo, you might just see one of these friends in that show.
Alex had the armadillo. I got a stick. But there's something else on the stick, too. This guy is a Solomon Island skink. Not a snake. This is a skink. This is a type of lizard that comes from the Solomon Islands. Lives its whole life up in the trees. Can find food, water, shelter, everything it needs up in the trees. And ours is named Pepper. It looks like someone is kind of shaking a pepper shaker all over its body. Now, these guys have some cool tools and adaptations that help us out. When we go out to different places, learn about different environments like the rainforest where this guy would live. Now, these guys have these big sharp claws that they use to grab and hold on the tree branches. They can climb right side up and even upside down, and they have a big long tail. I would love to have a tail like this. My pants look a little bit strange. I would love to have a big long tail like this that you grab and hold on to things with that tail, just like a monkey's tail or an elephant's trunk. These guys, they also are total vegetarians. They eat roots, they eat vegetables, they eat lots and lots of different things, just like that. Now, we don't have these guys here in Minnesota. We do have a little tiny lizard, so it's a great way to be able to show the kids of Minnesota that there are cool animals right here, just like in the rainforest, that where these guys come from. Any questions? Anything you guys would like to know? A little thing that I didn't tell you guys about? Does he roll like a ball? Never tried. But no, this guy doesn't roll like a ball. He's totally fit. Total camouflage, even his eyeballs are camouflage. So his whole body is, and then when it's sitting up in the trees, scientists have a really hard time finding these guys. They'll actually shoot a net up into the trees and stay in that hammock, stay in that net with all the supplies being brought right up to them, and that's how they study these. Kind of strange. Living in the little treehouse for a while, but that's how it works. Thank you very much for letting me show off my cool animals.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing the animals out. Now you all took pictures. So what you do on that those pictures is you post. You say, I met Artemis and Pepper today, and I voted to support the Minnesota Zoo. So you can go see them, too. So our bill request today is requesting funding for the Minnesota Zoo, $3.5 million per year, to establish a sustainable 50-50 public-private funding model. This investment is critical to maintaining the zoo's excellence in conservation, education, and animal welfare while addressing the rising costs and operational pressures. State funding currently covers only 37% of the zoo's budget, and this request moves us toward a sustainable 50-50 partnership. I addressed the rising key costs of drivers being rising workforce costs, aging infrastructure, and increasing regulatory requirements that are demanded to meet immediate investment. Supporting a statewide asset is what we are doing here today with this funding bill. The zoo welcomes 1.5 million visitors annually, contributes $227 million to Minnesota's economy, and serves all 87 counties in a variety of ways by coming out to nursing homes, coming to schools, and as you've seen. So now I'd like to introduce Director John Frawley. He's the director of the Minnesota Zoo, who will provide further insight into how this funding will enable the zoo to maintain its role as Minnesota's top year-round gated attraction. Thank you, members.
Welcome, Director Frawley. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Representative. Madam Chair and committee members, John Frawley, director of the Minnesota Zoo, also joined by a staff member.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Abigail Mosier. I'm the chief operating officer at the Minnesota Zoo.
Madam Chair, committee members, today I'd like to just go over three areas. First of all, I'll give you some highlights of how the Minnesota Zoo is doing, a little bit of an update on the zoo. I'd like to go over the governor's budget recommendation and the impact of that budget rec. And then also, thank you, Rep. Bierman, go over the Minnesota Zoo's budget request. A little bit about the Minnesota Zoo. We are a state agency. It is a public-private partnership. We only right now, it's a good partnership. Right now we receive 37% of our funding from the state, 63% we have to have a business model, just like a Main Street. We have to earn revenue, we have to roll up our sleeves and make the zoo function as a strong business. So we're very proud that of that relationship and how we've been able to drive and support the zoo. We are the fifth largest zoo in the country. The average zoo in our country is less than 30 acres. We're 500 acres. Good example, Como Zoo and Lake Superior Zoo are both 15, 16 acre zoos. The Minnesota Zoo is 500 acres, so we are a large zoo. We're a 24/7, 365 campus, just like a hospital. So it's a very, it's like almost running a small city. We're very proud of our access programs at the zoo. Right now we're reaching over 120,000 people with our Free to Explore. In other words, if you qualify for general assistance, you come to the Minnesota Zoo. So I like to say the Minnesota Zoo is free to those who Minnesotans who need it to be free. We run the largest, or we're one of the largest education leaders in the state, reaching over 83,000 students, over 1,000 Minnesota schools. We run the largest zoo camp or in the country. We have award-winning conservation. But I also point out the zoo is actually 50 years old, 47 open to the public, but the structures of the zoo are 50 years old. A little snapshot of this last year, we're very proud of what we've achieved after 47 years. We've reached the highest attendance in the history of the zoo. We are Minnesota's top year-round gated attraction with over 1.5 million visitors. We're a world-class destination ranked as one of the top zoos by USA Today. We just opened the longest treetop trail in the world, which has been award-winning. And then you can see the Star and Tribune year after year, we receive the top awards in the Minnesota best categories and gold. So very proud of the team and what the zoo has achieved. To go into the governor's recommendation for the zoo, the governor's rec is $1,038,000 for the biennium, which is a 1.3% of our total operating budget. So obviously this is a concern to us. We'd like to outline some of the impact of the current recommendation. The proposed fundings fall short of covering our existing institutional expenses, not allowing us to maintain our current operating levels and forcing us to consider major changes. And obviously we want to try to maintain those operating levels to achieve that number one destination in Minnesota that we have right now. But with this rec, we would have to look at staffing reductions, increased admissions, which is something we're very focused on trying to keep low and keep the zoo accessible and not just raising the prices. But we would have to look at camp prices, membership prices, field trip rates, hours of operation, special attractions, and limiting those access programs. The rec is at that scale that would have those types of impacts that we'd have to explore. These changes would diminish the guest experiences, negatively affecting our bottom line. And you know what that would mean is with this one-third, two-thirds relationship, we'd require more support from the state down the road to make up the difference. The Minnesota Zoo's request for 26-27 funding to maintain the current levels of service, as Rep. Bierman pointed out, is $3.5 million per year. Our current situation at the zoo, it is a public-private partnership. Like I said, right now the state covers about 30% of that partnership. The zoo's worked hard over the years, growing our earned revenue by 40% since 2019. But at this time, the timing's critical that we balance that scale and head towards the 50-50 public-private partnership. Our long-range forecasts, our long-range modeling, which we take very serious, show that over the next two bienniums, this and the next one, that's what we need to achieve this 50-50 relationship with the state. That's what's going to ensure long-term success as Minnesota's top destination. What's driving this? Why do we need to get to this 50-50 model? I think you've seen a lot of these in other presentations. We have tremendous workforce challenges, you know, salary increases, minimum wage, paid leaves, shift differential. Remember, we're a 24/7 operation. Our operating costs are growing at the 10% annual growth rate. As I mentioned before, our aging infrastructure is a concern. Last year, we had over 3,000 work orders that were non-bondable work orders for that 50-year-old campus. And then we are subject to increased regulatory standards, USDA, OSHA, Fish and Wildlife, FDA, EPA, to name a few. So, Madam Chair, committee members, I did bring a graph into the presentation to kind of show you this 50-50 public-private partnership. I really want to point out the request today moves us halfway to that partnership. So if you look at the graph, the 26-27 forecast shows if we would receive that 3.5, and then we would come back in the next biennium to try to close that final gap in the 28-29 biennium to get to that 50-50 partnership, that halfway model that makes the zoo sustainable long term. With that, Madam Chair, I think I would take questions. I think we have a unique state agency here. Hopefully you can see that. And I think we have a strong return on investment for the citizens of Minnesota. So I stand for questions.
Thank you, Dr. Frawley. We do have another testifier who is going to be joining us on Zoom. Jeanette Dean, if you can begin your testimony, if you're able to limit it to about 90 seconds or 2 minutes. Go ahead and proceed. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Okay, certainly. I'm Jeanette Dean, and I'm representing Sierra Club's North Star chapter, and specifically our Forest and Wildlife Stewards Group. And we represent 50,000 supporters and members across Minnesota. So one of our key policy initiatives at the national and state level as part of our wildlife and native plants policy is to support policies and organizations that help with threatened and endangered species, including recovery programs that protect wildlife, plants, and natural ecosystems. And as part of that would be our support for zoos, aquaria, and botanical gardens that also serve important educational preservation, meaning conservation, and scientific needs, as well as international cooperation, work between organizations that works toward conservation work. And we know that wildlife, plants, and their ecosystems have value in their own right, as well as value to humans and to the health of the biosphere. So we are in support of the funding that helps the zoo meet that 50-50 partnership. We feel that's a valid and well-warranted request, so we support that. And we're very proud of their status as a crown jewel in our state and country for the conservation work they do, as well as the learning and educational programs.
Thank you, Ms. Dean, for your testimony. I'm going to move us to member questions and start with Co-Chair Heintzman. Okay. Other member questions or comments for the presenters or the bill author? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to appreciate Mr. Frawley for your presentation and all the detail that's provided here. You note the additional costs that are on board. Obviously, at least from my lens, a $20 minimum wage is a pretty big increase. So I'm seeing those workforce challenges. Those are heavy for us. But when you're looking at the investments that have been made in recent years, I think that one of the top things is the treetop trail. Has that driven additional attendance and additional growth for the zoo?
Director Frawley.
Madam Chair, committee members, definitely the treetop trail has been a critical part for the last few years of traffic. So it's been award-winning, and had a significant impact on our increased attendance. And I think that's the challenge that we have, is we have to, with that one-third, two-thirds relationship, we have to keep creating these experiences that can drive traffic and help us earn that two-thirds part of our budget, or that second half is what we're hoping for in the future. But those types of new attractions and destinations are important to us.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I and can you outline for the committee, you know, as it's presented here, this balance and where this principle and balance around 50-50 comes from, or what you're seeking to, and where is that based in, or how are we operating from that perspective?
Director Frawley.
Do you want to that one?
Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Abigail Mosier. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at the Minnesota Zoo. And so the framework would continue to be the same in the sense that we're established in statute as a public-private partnership, but also as a state agency. And so we receive the appropriations from the state, and then we use that as a baseline and the infrastructure from which we then go and roll up our sleeves with our business model and raise the other, in that case, half.
Thank you, Ms. Mosier. Any other questions or comments from committee members? Seeing none, I turn it over to you, Representative Bierman, for your closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members, for hearing the proposal. I hope you can make it out to the Minnesota Zoo soon. It's a good day to go any time of year out there, so there's a lot to see. I wanted to thank Director Frawley and Ms. Mosier and Artemis and Pepper as well. So I guess they've taken off back to the zoo, but thank you for your time and appreciate your consideration for the request. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. I renew my motion that House File 2034 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. The bill is laid over. Our second bill on our agenda today is House File 1843. Representative Ream will make her way up to the dais. And since she is not a member of the committee, I will move House File 1843 to be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. And our hope is that this is perhaps about a 20-minute examination of the bill. Representative Ream, when you are ready, please begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm here to present House File 1843. And just by starting out to say thank you very much for supporting Lawns to Legumes in the past. We are asking for an extension or expansion of the program. And just so you're aware of how popular the Lawns to Legume program is, I'm going to highlight a couple things here. One is that more than 41,000 applications have been received for individual support grants. Projects have been funded in all 87 counties, and over 50 businesses have been supported by the program. And we have a number of testifiers today who want to speak in support of it. You have a large packet with many letters in support too. So good reading for this evening if you haven't read it already. But yeah, if we want to call up testifiers, that would be great. I think, you know, I come from Chanhassen where we have the Minnesota Landscape Arboretum and we have the Apple House. And I will say pollinators contribute to our economy as well. The value of pollination services is estimated to be at least $11.8 million per year in apple crops alone. So if you like apples, if you like Honeycrisp, which was developed at the Apple House in Chanhassen, you're going to want to help pollinators. So, yeah, if anyone has questions, we can talk about that later, but would love to pull up the testifiers to help testify.
Thank you, Representative Ream. Our first testifier, we're going to ask folks to keep it to about a minute and a half. Our first testifier is Laura Scholl from Metro Blooms. On deck, Kendra Sommerfeld. Please, Laura, make your way up to the dais and try to keep your marks to a minute and a half. We're going to have a little timer so the sound will go off if you can wrap up comments then. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
You. Thank you so much for having me. My name is Laura Scholl. I live in Lionel Lakes, Minnesota with my family and have been the executive director at the nonprofit Metro Blooms for the past 3 years. Metro Blooms partners with community across Minnesota on clean water and pollinator habitat projects, and through our Blue Thumb education program, we work with the Board of Water and Soil Resources to implement the Lawns to Legumes program, the individual grants piece of that. Those $400 reimbursement grants are maybe the most well-known piece of the program, but the program is really designed and carried out in such a way to meet every Minnesotan where they're at. In addition to grant funding, people can access coaching, workshops, resources, a helpline, and education. So the program really extends well beyond those individual reimbursement grants. The program is for everyone. It's utilized across the state, projects in all 87 counties. Another example is 600,000 people have visited program web pages over the last 5 years, so it really extends beyond the people that are directly participating and receiving those grants as well. And there are also demonstration neighborhood projects that are more community-focused. It's my understanding that 2 years ago when funding was last appropriated, the intention was to maintain that support as long as there was clear interest in the program. Every year, more people apply than we can help. In the last month, we've received almost 6,000 applications for the fall 2025 funding group. You've received letters urging you to support this programming from dozens of organizations and local governments. You have written and verbal testimony, and I'm sure you've each heard from constituents in your district. That is your proof. We ask that you prioritize the interest of your constituents and provide the necessary funding to continue this program.
Thank you, Ms. Scholl.
And in doing so, save our pollinators and protect clean water through native plants. Such a simple, really beautiful and impactful thing that we can do.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up is Kendra Sommerfeld, please. And on deck is Rachel Farrell. Thank you. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, everyone. My name is Kendra Sommerfeld, and I am here to urge you to support this bill for funding for lawns to legumes programming. It's not just an investment in pollinator habitat. It's also a tool for public education and long-term environmental change. For those of us that work in natural resources, such as myself, this program has been a huge tool for reaching our communities and empowering them to make small changes to their, you know, personal landscapes, but also in their neighborhoods. They're making wide changes in their neighborhoods as well. It also provides an accessible way for everyday people to engage with these important environmental issues, from pollinators, but all the way to water quality and sustainable landscaping. And it helps them understand that all of these issues are connected. Lawns to Legumes has shown that a small individual action, such as replacing a patch of lawn with native plants, can spark a broader shift in how Minnesotans think of conservation. This program isn't just about planting native plants for pollinators, it's about changing our perspectives too. Since 2019, over 12,000 Minnesotans have taken part, transforming 14 million square feet into pollinator-friendly habitat. And with this change, we've also engaged those thousands of people in conversations about sustainable landscapes, pollinator-friendly policies, and negative impacts of lawns.
And then, Sommerfeld, if you could wrap up, please.
Yes.
Thank you.
So, by this program, we see tons of neighborhood changes and actions. And so cutting the funding doesn't just halt this program. It also halts the momentum and the changes that we've seen. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, Rachel Farrell. And on deck is Karen Randall. Please state your name for the record and welcome to the committee.
Hello, members of the committee. Thank you for having me. My name is Rachel Farrell. I'm here and really grateful to be able to speak to my experience with the Lawns to Legumes program. I have the benefit of having been both a recipient of the grant as well as a coach for the last three cycles in helping people to start on their native plant journey. I want to be able to talk about how I started, which was frankly on my own and without support. And I can tell you it's a lot easier with the support of a established program like this and the education that it provides. I actually started in a garage in White Bear Lake, meeting with members of a group who shared free seeds from their own lawn. I got the grant after that and proceeded to expand from the 50 plus species that I had put in on my own to the side lawn and the front lawn of my Columbia Heights home. I want to talk a little bit about what it means to be supported in the grant as a coach. I have the opportunity to help people who have an idea that they want to start but don't know how, and I want to liken it to the experience of going to Costco and trying a sample. A lot of people know that they might want to try something, but without the opportunity to be supported and try it for free or have that gate or barrier removed, a lot of people don't know where to start. And the important part in native plants is to start. Because once you start, you get the opportunity to see what it means to have more bees, butterflies, moths, birds, mammals in your yard, and it helps to shift things away from parks being the things that save us to actually the bugs that are around us are the things that save us and help us. Please support this program going forward. I really look forward to the opportunity to help people and to continue to help people to start on this journey. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Farrell. Next up, Karen Randall, followed by James Wolfen. Please state your name for the record and proceed for about 90 seconds, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Karen Randall. I'm in St. Paul, and I'm here to encourage you to support the Bill 1843, which funds the Lawns to Legumes program. It is a proven effective in increasing pollinator habitat across Minnesota, a critical step in reversing the decline of insects and protecting our food web. I just want to note that a recent study published in Science analyzed butterfly population data from 35 monitoring programs. It found that butterflies' numbers have dropped by 22% in the last 20 years. That includes impacting 113 species, specifically in St. Paul. Butterflies are vital pollinators, and their caterpillars are an essential food source for other species. This decline interrupts entire ecosystems. The primary causes are habitat loss, pesticides, and climate change. Lawns to Legumes helps Minnesota residents create native habitats essential to butterfly and pollinator survival. As an experienced gardener and a volunteer coach with the program for the past 4 years, I have witnessed its impact firsthand. What makes Lawns to Legumes so powerful is how it inspires individuals to take action in their own yards. It equips people with practical knowledge and offers modest financial support in turn to turn that knowledge into reality. As a coach, I guide recipients, many of them who are new to gardening or unfamiliar with native plants, through planning and planting process. They're eager to move beyond the traditional grass-only lawns that we see all around us and provide little nourishment for pollinators. The program gives them the confidence and the resources to make a change. Some examples, a suburban homeowner transformed a sloping lawn into a woodland meadow. A townhouse renter persuaded her homeowners association to allow a rain garden to manage stormwater runoff. And a new homeowner in northern Minnesota looked at the rock mulch around her yard and realized she really needed to take it out and put in a pollinator-friendly garden.
Thank you, Ms. Randall. Please finish. Thank you. James Wolfen, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your 1.5-minute testimony, please.
Hello, my name is James Wolfen. I'm proud to be a University of Minnesota alumni with a master's in ecology, a pollinator biologist, a former Lawns to Legumes program administrator, a current Lawns to Legumes volunteer coach, and hopefully, and most importantly, a representative from a small Minnesota business, Twin City Seed Company. Historically at Twin City Seed, we have had a focus on the distribution of turfgrass and agricultural seeds, but since the onset of Lawns to Legumes, we've seen a dramatic increase in demand for pollinator-friendly planting options, not just from residents, but also from small, family-owned and operated businesses we service throughout the state of Minnesota. In the year prior to Lawns to Legumes, our B-Lawn and native pollinator-friendly planting options accounted for approximately 200 pounds of seed distributed to residents and green industry partners. In the most recent fiscal year, these products accounted for more than 20,000 pounds, or an increase of more than 10,000%. The nurseries, greenhouses, landscape professionals, and other small businesses that we partner with are not confined to the Twin Cities metro area, but rather they are spread out widely throughout the state of Minnesota, including Landsberg Nursery in Brainerd, Copper Creek Garden Center in Nisswa, Wagon Seed Farm in Meeker County, and many more. The economic impact of this program is being felt strongly throughout all corners of the state of Minnesota. To date, state funding has provided Minnesotans with more than $2 million in awards to residents. These very same residents have spent almost $1,750,000 of their own money on these projects. For every dollar that comes from the state, Minnesotans are choosing to spend 86 cents of their own money, nearly a one-to-one match. And this is money that is not just given to residents the second they are awarded a grant. The vast majority of funds are reimbursed only after the money has been spent, with much of this money going right into the pockets of Minnesota small businesses. With all of this in mind, I urge the committee here today and the Minnesota House of Representatives to support our pollinators, support our residents, and support our family-owned and operated small Minnesota businesses by supporting HF 1843, the Lawns to Legumes program. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Wolfen. I did not give a heads up that Katie Lucy will be up next, followed by Don Georgiev, which you will have to correct my pronunciation. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and try to keep your testimony to about a minute and a half.
Hi, my name is Katie. I was a Lawns to Legumes recipient, and hold on, let me just get my... There's an old saying that goes, if you build it, they will come. I got to thinking about that as I was sitting outside watching a butterfly in my backyard last summer. That saying can be changed into other phrases too, like, if you plant it, they will come. In fact, if it wasn't for the help of my Lawns to Legumes grant, I wouldn't have witnessed the monarch butterfly in my backyard. You see, with the help of that grant, I helped our rusty patch bumblebee and a monarch butterfly thrive. I will never forget the day I found out that I was a Lawns to Legumes recipient. I would have thought I had won the lottery. The date was December 15, 2023, to be exact. I took a picture of it. I was looking online for native pollinator plants before I went shopping when I went to the 2024 Hennepin County Master Gardener's Spring Plant Sale in Hopkins. I threw caution to the wind. I filled my foldable shopping cart up to the top faster than a contestant on supermarket sweep. I got home and organized my little seedlings by height and sunshade tolerance, and I began planting them. Because I'm over the top, I did three areas of native pollinator plantings, one in my front yard and two in my backyard. As a Lawns to Legumes recipient, I volunteered to be a host for a garden tour where I shared what knowledge I had gained along the way with fellow gardeners. It was fun to engage with other gardeners and share my love of native pollinators. The icing on the cake was when my Lawns to Legumes sign arrived in the mail. I urge you to support this.
Thank you so much, Ms. Lucy. Our next testifier will be our the last person on the list for in-person before we move to our Zoom testifiers is Dawn. In the room, please help me with the pronunciation of your last name and try to keep your testimony to about a minute and a half. Thank you.
Dawn Georgieff.
Georgieff, yeah. Thank you.
I'm speaking as a beekeeper and also as someone who's been involved in a lot of the community science projects for native bees with the University of Minnesota. We need these pollinators. As people have spoken before, the amount of insects is drastically increasing. There's clearly interest across the whole state for this program. 12,000 Minnesotans since 2019 have received grants, and as spoken before, in the first week of this current cycle, apparently 4,700 people applied. So this is not a political issue. There's interest in all the states, and I'm sure for all the parties. I just urge you to vote yes or continue funding for HF 1843.
Thank you, Ms. Georgieff. We're going to move to our first Zoom testifier, Rosemary Malfi. If you are able to take yourself off mute, introduce yourself for the record and try to keep your testimony to about a minute and a half. Thank you.
Sounds good. Can you hear me?
Yes, you sound great. Go ahead.
Okay, wonderful. Okay, my name is Rosemary Malfi. I am the policy director at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation, and I'm here to convey our very strong support for Minnesota's Lawn to Legumes program and the bill that will keep it funded, HB 1843. We are, as an organization, work with producers across Minnesota to install pollinator habitat, and our Minnesota senior conservation biologist was actually instrumental in helping to conceive of and execute the Lawns to Legumes program. So we actually had a hand in its creation and the standards that are involved. As other folks have said, insect pollinators like bees and butterflies are in decline across the U.S., including in the Midwest. Habitat loss is one of the major drivers of insect pollinator declines. Lawns to Legumes is so wonderful because it empowers Minnesota residents to be a part of the solution to reversing pollinator declines. Everyone can do their part. And if you take nothing else away from today, this is the point that I want you to remember. Science actually supports this program. There are studies, and more of them are coming out all the time, that show that these really small-scale changes can have a huge impact. If you change the amount of plants that are available, the amount of native plants that are available, and the composition of those plants, the diversity, you can have very immediate changes in the number of insects, the number of pollinators that are in that space. You really can make a difference yard by yard. I talk about this program as a policy director to other folks in other states who are interested in pollinator legislation. This is one of the first things I usually mention because it's just so innovative and positive and a community building tool. And every time I mention this to somebody, a legislator or someone who's working on policy in a different state, they just think it is the most wonderful idea. So Minnesota is a leader in this way, and I hope it stays that way.
Thank you, Ms. Malfi. And our final testifier I have on my list via Zoom, Jeanette Dean, please try to keep your comments to about a minute and a half and proceed.
Certainly. Yes, Jeanette Dean, representing Sierra Club statewide, as well as our Forest and Wildlife Stewards Group. We represent over 50,000 members and supporters across Minnesota. We work to protect the health of our communities, protect wildlife, and preserve our remaining wild places and native plants. And that's why we were in such strong support of this bill in 2023 and the funding it provided, $2 million each in 2024 and 2025. And we urge passage of this bill with the funding of at least $1.5 million to keep the program going. As others showed, there were over 41,000 applications and 12,000 were able to be served. So we need to keep doing that. And I do remember that when Brad Tabke introduced it, University of Minnesota Professor Dr. Marla Spivak was there, and she and Dr. Elaine Evans said how much the program helped fulfill their goals to help recover the rusty patch bumblebee and help prevent declines of other bumblebees so they don't reach that endangered status as well. So again, we encourage that, and we have heard as well that the plant and flower pollen and nectar, due to plant chemistry, help to boost pollinators' immune systems and detoxify them from existing pesticides. And so that's another benefit.
Thank you, Ms. Dean.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify who has not for or against this bill? If not, we will move to member questions. Co-chair Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Co-chair. There's a number of questions that I have and a couple comments as well. I will just start by some simple math. We're looking at a cost in this program, if we've run the numbers yet again, another season of this bill coming forward under different authorship, of $15,000 an acre, with also, I believe, about 321 total acres affected. And testifiers pointing out that this is having an impact on a micro scale as a positive, that's true, but at what cost? And at a time that we have a looming $6 billion deficit, we're looking at another $1.5 million being appropriated from the general fund for the Lawns to Lagoons program. This is, I think, arguably fiscal irresponsibility. I do have a question for Mr. Hagemeyer and then a question for the bill author. I just want to confirm that the previous language carried by Representative Tabke was that a one-time appropriation or was that a ongoing statutory appropriation?
Mr. Hagemeyer.
Madam Chair, Representative Heintzman, I don't remember which appropriation Representative Tabke carried, but there was an appropriation in 2024 of $800,000 from the general fund one time, and then there was also created a pollinator habitat account in the special revenue fund. The pollinator habitat account has a statutory appropriation. It could be used for lawns to legumes. It could possibly be used for some other pollinator habitat program, I guess. Those are the two from the last session.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I know my members have questions and we're short on time, so I will probably leave that there. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair Frisell. So I just, as I'm thinking about this, 12,000 recipients, I also have quite the perennial garden. If anybody wants to come tour, I would welcome you there, and I would share the bounty. So I'm guessing the majority of the folks that have received $350 or more for these grants have planted perennials, is my guess. Correct. I'm seeing a lot of heads nodding. Okay, so I have my great-great-grandma Hag's perennials in my garden, and I've shared the bounty with dozens and dozens of people. So I would be curious for the author of the bill or anybody that's in the audience, have you thought about the recipients that have received this bounty that you could actually grow your community by sharing, like sharing your plants and seeds? So like, for example, my zinnias. I bought one pack of zinnias 6 years ago, and I harvest my seeds from my zinnias, my favorite ones, and I'd be willing to share here around the table. But zinnias bring in a bounty of butterflies, bees, all the great things. And it started with one pack that was like $1.19, and for at least 6 years now, I have never had to buy more zinnias, and I get so many. I have an amazing experience with it. So I'd be curious, like, if we could really be fiscally responsible and think about how could your community grow, because I do not see that this, as I serve on human services, both health and finance, and I think about our most vulnerable populations in our state that are needing care, how are we going to prioritize where the money goes? And I was wondering if you ever did think about how you could split up, you know, if you have a community, Facebook pages where you could share for free and build relationships, and that the funding, you know, the $1.5 million, I could definitely see that going towards folks with disabilities over this, but I think there could be something here that we could do for free, because I've been blessed by being out in the dirt and you know, just seeing what's happened in my yard too. So,
thank you, Representative Gilman. Representative Ream?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Gilman, for bringing that forward. I will say right now that the interest for this program exceeds what we can do. So I think ideas like yours are really good. I know my local library has a seed library right now. And I think it's very common for gardeners to share seeds and to share plants. And I think that would be a great way to expand this. But I do think, like, there are a lot of people who don't have that friendly neighbor who can bring over some plants or who can teach them about gardening. So I think it's really great to have this program in place, because it not only comes with some funding, it comes with a coach. So if you win the lottery, you get someone to help coach you and teach you how to grow gardens that are friendly to pollinators. So, but I do like your idea, and I think it's something certainly we could look into, because I think the idea of a seed library, a local seed library, you know, and we do it through our Carver County Library System, I think that's a pretty cool idea. And if anyone else wants to testify in support of that too, that would be great.
And I don't see any other member. Oh, Representative Schultz, maybe our last one, and we'll let Lucy, Representative Ream, close out. Go ahead, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Ream. I've also been kind of going through these applicants and awardees, and it seems like certain communities had a hard time getting from applicant to actually awarded. Can you kind of outline for me what, you know, that would be caused by? Seems like there's a whole bunch around the Southern Metro, my own district, 227 applicants, 37 awarded. The number of communities that were under 30 awarded. What would that have been caused by?
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Representative Ream.
I do have, I don't know if you have it in front of you, but I do have information on the Lawns and Legumes applicants and awardees throughout the Minnesota House districts. And I will say, you know, like there's a great demand. I'm not exactly sure how they do the awarding. I do think it has a lot to do with where the rusty patch bumblebee is in need of extra help. So I think that factors into where these awards are given. But I'm happy to have someone else also speak to that, if there's someone here who could speak to how, you know, what criteria they use.
Anyone want to step up to that? That was my understanding, too, is when this first rolled out that it was prioritizing the native habitat of the rusty patch bumblebee specifically. We may have a friend coming to give that response. Please identify yourself for the record, and if you are able to address representative's query. Thank you.
Certainly, Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Andrea Fish. I'm here with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And to address the question from Representative Schultz, and yes, it is primarily to target the rusty-patched bumblebee, which does have area within the metro area down through southeast Minnesota. In future round of applicants, we are working on continuing to
make sure that the funding is a little more equally distributed across the strait as we've gotten through those first priority targeted areas.
Thank you, Ms. Fish. Closing comments, Representative Ream.
Yeah, so great segue, because I don't know if you know who or what our state bee is, but it is a rusty patched bumblebee. The scientific name is Bombus affinis. It's has been currently listed as endangered. These bees are found in grasslands and prairies, including areas around the Twin Cities metro area. The rusty patch bumblebee has disappeared from 87% of its historic range across the U.S. Starting about 25 years ago, the Bombus affinis had a 90% population decline, is what was something I'd read recently. So I think programs like this really help our pollinators. I know people have talked about how we have fewer insects. We also have fewer birds. You know, we're seeing a real decline. And so programs like this, not only are they helping people grow gardens, help the pollinators, but they're also bringing about awareness of what some of our species are facing right now with climate change and other, you know, habitat destruction. And the program has three important components that I just wanted to highlight. It has a public education and outreach campaign. That's one. Two is it has individual landowner support. So not only do people receive a grant, but they also receive coaches to help them out, and there are also workshops. And then three, the third component is the Pollinator Pathways Program, which awards larger grants to build the corridors, which is really important when we're looking at saving our bees and other pollinators. So thank you, and I appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Ream. I renew my motion that House File 1843 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. The bill is laid over. Our next bill on the calendar, which we're hoping maybe we can confine to 10-ish minutes, is House File 1611, similar name for this program, as Representative Hansen makes his way up to the dais. Representative Hansen, would you like to move your bill before the committee for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would move that House File 1611 be laid over for possible inclusion in the future bill.
Thank you. Representative Hansen, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's good to follow up off of the lawns to legumes and talk a little bit about food. There's the old saying, if you give someone a fish, they will eat today. If you teach them to fish, they will be able to fish and eat for a lifetime. And so what the Lawns to Lunch program pilot project, again, this is not a program but a pilot project, takes the successful model of lawns to legumes and does it for gardening. And so teaching people to convert their lawn into gardens so that they can have food. So if you look at 1611, it goes through the Board of Water and Soil Resources for a pilot project to provide similar financial and technical assistance to plant residential landscapes with food gardens, including vegetables, fruits, fruit trees, other foods, flowering plants necessary to facilitate pollination of the vegetables, fruits, or other food planting. And it says the Board of Water and Soil Resources may enter into agreements with local governments, the University of Minnesota Master Gardener Program, and other nonprofits to support this effort. So in summary, it is taking the model of lawns to legumes. We know that food diversity and food resilience is critical. Teach people how to garden for a lifetime of local eating, local foods. So I would ask for your support, and I believe there are testifiers.
Thank you. How appropriate to come from the agriculture co-chair. We do have one person signed up who, again, is Jeanette Dean joining us over Zoom. Ms. Dean, when you are ready, please begin your minute and a half long testimony.
Okay, yes. Good to be here again, Jeanette Dean. I'm representing Sierra Club's North Star chapter. We have 50,000 members and supporters across Minnesota who support our work. And as part of our nationwide goals, we do also have an agriculture and food policy. And we emphasize that objectives nationwide should seek to optimize output of critical nutritional needs and protection of the environment. And rather than being limited to maximizing quantities produced per acre only, and particularly in developed countries like ours, we believe there should be a reduction in excessive food consumption and waste patterns to allow maintenance of diet quality at a lower environmental cost. And an important first step would be to develop a greater reliance on healthy vegetable protein. And this bill would offer that through an emphasis on fruits and vegetables, as well as pollinator plants that would help grow those. So again, we'd like to emphasize the need to prioritize local food self-sufficiency above concentrated food production only and long distance support transport of food. And so those policies would again encourage local food producers, zoning codes that allow for urban, home, and community-based food production, which again this bill would allow, and appropriate scale regulation of farm and food safety.
Thank you, Ms. Dean.
So we do support the bill.
Thank you. Any other members of the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, we will begin member questions. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hansen. Thinking about this conversation, I don't think that I ever expected to see something quite like this. So can you kind of express to the committee why we would put Bowser in control of this?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Schultz. We want to make sure we're not having redundancy. The delivery mechanism that Bowser has and has established through Lawns to Legumes, they have the skill and the knowledge and that experience of doing it. So that's why it would be through the Board of Water and Soil Resources. They already have that experience. They've learned it. You're dealing with some of the same potential partners, and that's why it would go through Bowser.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, this sounds a lot like gardening. Not quite sure if Bowser has experience and knowledge in that, especially whether from like a regulatory perspective or just generally in their purpose or mission. And so my next question would be, how would we really measure success of a program like this?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Schultz. So Bowser is the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And in order to garden, you're going to need those, right? Water and soil, that's your medium, that's your method. And rather than turf grass, you're growing food. And if we look back to the 1940s, our parents or grandparents or great-grandparents had victory gardens. That was an effort where people tried to encourage people, and that skill was passed on for years of developing gardens to grow your own food. And so that's the rationale for this, is that growing your own food, doing that with the same type of technical assistance, not everybody knows how to. Just like we were talking about with all of the native plantings, not everybody knows how to garden. Not everybody knows how to be planting that. And by providing this technical assistance as well as small amounts of money, that can spur, I believe, more food resiliency, but also management. Would you rather be growing apple trees in your yard or turf?
Representative Schultz, final follow-up.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I do still, you know, on this particularly have a question, because I don't think that I heard the answer to how we would truly measure the success of a program like this. And also, I guess, so thinking about both measuring success, what would be those reporting requirements to Bowser?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Schultz, it would be just like with Lawns to Legumes and any other conservation contract where you're providing the receipts, you're showing what those costs were, there's a cost share that's involved with them, and the technical assistance. In addition, you would have that follow-up that like is done with Lawns to Legumes. Like we heard earlier today of people coming forward from all around the state saying, this is a good program, it helped me. I believe if you take that leap, you're going to find that with Lawns to Lunch as well. People are literally hungry for this type of program. They want it. And why not provide a little bit of assistance? We know that there are going to be cuts to the food systems at the federal level. The seed is a lot less expensive, and that experience can last a lifetime.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Representative Gottfried?
Just quickly, and just a quick
yes, Representative
response.
Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, you know, I don't see those reporting requirements in the bill. Might be something you want to look at as this bill moves forward. And I think I'm glad to hear that we have some bipartisan agreement, at least from what I heard in testimony, to help make America healthy again.
Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hansen. Just a quick question. The way that this is structured, would this allow this program also allow for co-synergies with local and maybe regional government programs that are going on? I know Metropolitan Council has an effort going on to install biosolar systems on roofs, which is the combination of green roofs and solar panels to increase resiliency. Just curious, would this be able to interface with programs like that? Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Gottfried, yes, it would be able to. And another example is in many communities, they have a community garden. It's a fairly small tract of land, and that there's usually oversubscribing to that of people who want to get in those community gardens. So providing that assistance, working with communities of any size to try to get these programs established, these plants established, actually, getting the plants established that provide food.
Representative Gottfried, follow up.
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen. To me, this is a very simple bill. This is about resiliency. This is about, you know, food resiliency, economic resilience, ecological resiliency, and I would be happy to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to go back. I do like the word resilience. And again, so I just want to just bring it back again when we're talking dollars and cents. Our time is so precious and valuable right now to get after our budget. So I just hope that we can look at just prioritizing, you know, public safety, healthcare, infrastructure in this budget crisis time. And I'm just grateful that we did, you know, we got to talk. I had two cities come in talking about water issues. And you're just thinking about, you know, is there going to be a bonding bill or not a bonding bill? But it was really great to be in committee and hear, but when I was listening to, like, folks that can't even drink water in their town. So when I think about resiliency and just thinking they can't drink the water, they have to drink bottled water, and that could have its own issues there too. I hope that we can look at this and try to get creative, create community. Like, there's communities everywhere in our cities where we live. And how can we show up and be there for our neighbors? And there is the majority of us have a cell phone. I mean, YouTube on how to do gardens versus having a coach. And so I don't know if Bowser is here or not, but I just wonder, are they involved at all in vegetable gardening? I don't know if Bowser is here or not, if they do anything with that type of thing.
Ms. Fish still in the room.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. Please approach the dais, introduce yourself for the record, and if you can address the representative's question. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, again, Andrea Fish, Board of Water and Soil Resources. Representative Gilman, to clarify the question, it was our experience with vegetable gardening,
yes,
in particular. I think my favorite part of working with land-based agencies is that we all dabble in a little something similar. So typically when you're talking about farming, conventional farming, as we think about it in Minnesota, that would be Department of Agriculture's purview. As Representative Hansen mentioned, our relationship with a program proposed like this is along the lines of the existing infrastructure and practices we have with something like Lawns to Legumes, where we have the individual support grants set up, we have websites, we have relationships with local producers of seed and other products.
Representative Gilman, any follow-up?
No, that's it. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hansen, to close on your bill, please.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking forward to Representative Schultz co-authoring the bill. That he sounds like he likes it. So I'd ask anybody to co-author the bill. I think this... I'll just turn back the time back to 6 years ago when we first came with Lawns to Legumes. Very similar questions were asked, a lot of doubt, a lot of questions, concerns, will this work? And it has become the most popular environmental program created in this state this century. And so here we're talking about food. It's a logical extension. We can teach people how to garden, teach people how to grow their own food. That does add to community and resiliency, and I believe even democracy. So thank you. I'd ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Hansen, who renews his motion that House File 1611 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. The bill is laid over, and we're going to do a little bit of musical chairs while I come to the dais, and Chair Jordan will take my spot.
Representative Purcell, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 1012 to be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill.
And Vice Chair Purcell, I believe you have an author's amendment. Would you move the A1 amendment and explain it for the committee?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So the A1 amendment was made after having some conversations with the Department of Natural Resources, the Environmental Quality Board, ATV Minnesota, some of my colleagues. So we changed the time in which to bring the public into the planning process to try to streamline that. Still early enough that public input is important, but not so early that it might cause unnecessary disruption. And we jettisoned the part of the bill that is looking at decommissioning trails and amended on Co-Chair Heintzman's bill, I don't have the number in front of me, 278, if that's right off the top of my head, which increases the ATV fees for since that bill did not get a hearing on our last ATV day, neither did this bill, so marrying them together to get them all into one bill.
Vice Chair Purcell moves the A1 amendment to get the form, to get the bill in the form the author would like. All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. All those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Vice Chair Purcell, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is a bill, if those of you were on the Environment Committee last year, you saw a different version of this bill. So this is a topic of conversation. I'm going to make my intro very brief because we have 17 people to testify both for and against the bill. There is a different standard for signage that is in one part of our state than there is in another. And I want to thank Ron from ATV Minnesota, where we had this meeting, and I got this tome dropped in my lap, the Trail Planning Design and Development Guidelines from the DNR. It's been really, I have not read the entire thing yet, but especially in section 3.2, the Guiding Principles for Sustainable Trails, that comes from the DNR as far back as 2006. So this bill especially is looking at those guiding principle number one, avoid sensitive ecological areas and critical habitats, all the way down to guiding principle seven, which is the formerly decommission and restore unsustainable trail corridors, which is no longer a part of this bill, but trying to put into statute what the DNR has said is best practices, what we have also seen from the federal level of what best practices are. And I just want to clarify what this bill does not do. It does not affect the 8,828 miles of the forest trail inventory. It does not affect more than 100,000 miles of trails accessible to ATVs statewide, including county miles. It also does not affect the hunter exemptions. So our current law regarding signage on trails is different north of Highway 2, which is where 70% of our state's public lands reside. So that's the section of the state where there is a trail. It looks like an ATV trail. It's considered a trail unless it is marked closed, versus in my part of the state, it is only a trail if there's a sign that marks it as such. So what this bill will do is unify the policy for ATV trails across Minnesota. I'd now like to turn it over to our 17 testifiers. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Purcell. Testifiers, you will all have 1.5 minutes. I will, there are a lot of testifiers. We want to give everyone a chance to make their voices heard. So please keep your testimony to 90 seconds. If you go beyond that, I will cut you off. First on the list is Susan Schubert from the Minnesota Public Lands Coalition. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Susan Schubert. I'm with Minnesota Public Lands. Thank you, Chair Jordan and Chair Heintzman and representatives for hearing this bill. The common sense measures in this bill, we believe, are needed more than ever. According to the 2024 DNR ATV statewide strategic master plan draft, maintenance dollars are limited. And DNR also stated in its 2023 10-year capital needs report that it had a maintenance backlog deficit of $480 million for trails and roads. This is why these common sense measures are so important to minimize impact and for the costly long-term maintenance needs for new trails. DNR and others say there are best management practices, and the 2007 DNR planning and guideline manual, which you saw, but as well as intentioned as these are, they are voluntary, arbitrarily followed, and not enforceable. The manual recommends buffer zones of 200 feet and to avoid wetlands and all sensitive ecological areas, which have been overlooked by projects in recent years. The recent Voyager ATV system phase two proposes to follow an ATV trail and would traverse old growth forests and classified areas of high significant biodiversity, introducing extremely damaging invasives to the area and soil erosion. We believe also, for example, the EAW measure for most projects is important. And in fact, it was an impetus for starting this coalition after locals read the DNR internal environmental review for the border-to-border route, which they had to request from data practices. To their disbelief, this report said the route would cross several trout streams. Locals knew the facts were that 27 trout streams would be crossed 61 times in one county alone. These are common sense measures that would help provide public transparency and help to protect the legacy of public lands for all stakeholders and future generations. Thank you.
Thank you. Next on my list is Willis Madison, and on deck is Commissioner Kelly Applegate. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Madison. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your 90-second testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Willis Madison. I'm from Osage, Minnesota. I'm 81 years old. I was raised on a farm and hunting and fishing. But asthma kept me from farming, so I went off to college and got my master's degree in ecology. My career was as a regional director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Scientists' opinions these days aren't respected as much as they used to be, so the common person's thoughts and opinions and observations seem to have more value. So I'm here today as an ATV owner, as a hunter, as a farm with my farm kid, Cat Han, and speaking not so much from textbooks, but from my experience. My mother's favorite birds of birds, wrens, bobolinks, meadowlarks, and bluebirds have virtually disappeared. Ducks and geese no longer darken our skies like they used to. And I don't catch as many fish as big and as many as I used to either. And have you noticed that bug screens aren't needed on cars like they used to be back in the 50s? This is because we've lost or chopped up habitat into too small fragments, with all manner of streets and roads and highways, power lines, pipelines, cables, ditches, and yes, ATV trails. We've trampled too much of our forest and our grasslands, and we've stressed our lakes and wetlands to death. We've strewn invasive species all across the landscape that compete with our natives. Like all forms of motorized activity, ATVs all over make all these problems worse because the effects are cumulative. Trails both take up and chop habitat into and produce dust, noise, and erode trails and pollute streams and lakes.
Thank ATV you for spreads. Your testimony.
Thank you.
Next on my list is Commissioner Kelly Applegate, and then next on the list we're going to go to some Zoom testimony. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Applegate. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Anin Buju, Miskwaskin Indigenous, Magizian Dodeim, I'm from the Mille Lacs area. My name is Kelly Applegate. I'm the Commissioner of Natural Resources for the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe. I'm here to testify in support of House File 1012. This bill is designed to preserve and protect wetland areas and natural habitats, including our sacred monomin, or what we call wild rice, and other sensitive areas from the impacts of motorized off-highway recreational vehicles across the state. As of April 2024, the state of Minnesota has recorded 522,000 motorized off-highway recreational vehicles. The state continues to issue permits for expanding trail systems and allocates grant and aid funding for the creation of additional off-highway vehicle trails that may be located near reservation lands and ceded territories where tribal members have federally protected hunting, fishing, and gathering rights. This activity has several acknowledged environmental impacts that threaten our delicate ecosystem. This bill proposes reasonable measures to address some of the primary consequences of this activity. Of utmost importance to us is engaging in consultation with tribal nations regarding off-highway recreational vehicle trail development that may traverse tribal lands and/or ceded territories.
Thank you. Next on my list is Jeff Burcham via Zoom, and then will be Gretchen Mehmel. Mr. Burcham, are you with us? Hi. Please proceed with your testimony, and please state your name for the record and proceed.
Hello. My name is Jeff Burcham. I'm a retired conservation officer with the Minnesota DNR. For most of my 31 years in law enforcement, I patrolled the Beltrami Island State Forest, which is north of Highway 2. The Beltrami is a managed forest, which means that any trail is open to off-highway vehicle use unless posted closed. One of my duties as a CO was to protect the environmental sensitive areas from illegal ATV operation. The major enforcement obstacle was maintaining the signs on closed trail areas. It was just too easy for ATV users to remove a closed sign. Without the signs, enforcement action was impossible to protect these closed areas. Conversely, if trails have to be signed for open access, like south of Highway 2, the signs stay up. Another major concern with the open unless posted closed situation is that many new ATV trails were started illegally. In a very short time, a new trail would be developed. Once a sign is tossed aside and not obvious, a trail, by definition, now open for use. The reason for there's so few violations on the books north of Highway 2 is because of enforcement efforts in a so-called managed forest is almost impossible. My recommendation as a former enforcement officer is to simplify the state's regulations and make it statewide that all trails are closed to operation unless designated and posted open for off-road vehicle use. This is what this proposed legislation does.
Thank you. Thank you. Next on my list is Gretchen Mehmel, also via Zoom.
Hello.
Hello.
My name is Gretchen Mehmel, and I am speaking in support of this bill. I retired from the DNR in 2022 as the manager of the Red Lake Wildlife Management Area. I've had considerable experience in managing both motorized and non-motorized trails. My former work area is within the Beltrami Island State Forest, which is currently classified as a managed forest where every trail without a sign specifically marking it closed is considered open. And this is true whether it is by design or by default in cases where the trail was created illegally by cross-country travel or where the trail closed sign was removed by a user. This is a problem that causes damage to our forests and costs a lot of time and labor for DNR staff to manage in terms of replacing signs, repairing damaged areas, and having to place physical barriers across closed trails where signs keep disappearing. With this legislation, field staff can instead focus on making a high-quality off-road vehicle system. Making trails open for motorized vehicles where their use is appropriate and does not cause any damage is never a problem. These trails provide good access for people using motorized vehicles as they are on high ground with soil that can sustain motorized traffic and allows for a much better managed system of trails. Marking trails open for use rather than closed provides ATV and other off-road riders with the well-managed trails they desire. This bill does that, and it also would unify state policy north and south of Highway 2.
Thank you. Next on my list is Bruce Anderson. After that will be Amadeo Bayino. Mr. Anderson, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Bruce Anderson, and I'd like to thank the committee members for the opportunity. I'm representing the Wildlife Society. I'm retired, but have had 34 years experience with the U.S. Forest Service as a wildlife manager and recreation program leader, and 4 years with the DNR as an assistant wildlife manager. I have a considerable experience in managing both motorized and non-motorized trails in Montana, Idaho, and Minnesota. Our primary concern is motorized impacts on wildlife, and we view and support this bill as a means to minimize those impacts. This legislation takes nothing away from the current ATV user. According to DNR data, there are over 101,000 miles of roads, trails open to ATVs on public lands. This legislation is about protecting wildlife habitat from an expanded ATV network. Rare wildlife numbers are declining. The DNR now lists over 570 species of greatest conservation need, a 96% increase from 2005. Many of these species are found in the northern third of the state where many of the new proposed ATV trails are planned. Motorized recreation's impact on wildlife is significant and well documented. Research has shown that ATV use can affect habitat, reduce productivity and survival rates, and alters animal behavior. Consider that ATV noise can be heard over a half mile away and under ideal conditions up to 3 miles away. The more ATV trail connectivity, the less wildlife habitat connectivity, such as wildlife travel corridors. With this legislation, potential impacts to wildlife can be mitigated.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on my list is Amadeo Bayino. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Amadeo Bolino. I'm the Government Relations Specialist for the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, testifying on behalf of our Division of Resource Management. I want to thank you for your time today to offer our support of House File 1012. This bill takes critical steps to protect Minnesota's land, wildlife, and cultural resources from the impacts of unmanaged off-highway vehicle use. For far too long, OHV trails have been expanded without meaningful consultation with tribal nations. This bill ensures that tribal lands and ceded territories cannot be included in OHV trails without explicit tribal approval, a necessary step in respecting tribal sovereignty and protecting cultural significant areas. The current managed trails and managed forest systems is failing. Note that 5-way 2, every trail is open unless posted closed, which encourages illegal trail creation and prevents conservation officers from citing riders unless a closed sign is posted. This bill moves towards unifying state policy by requiring clear mapping and designated trails. This bill does not restrict the use of trails. Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe is in support of recreational use. We support this legislation because it makes trails use more responsible, sustainable, and respectful of the land. This bill is necessary for long-term land stewardship.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on my list is Ron Potter from ATV Minnesota. Next will be Commissioner Rick Gudermont. But in the meantime, Mr. Potter, please proceed to the table. State your name for the record when you're ready and proceed.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Ron Potter. I thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. I am the current president of the All-Terrain Vehicle Association of Minnesota. Our association, along with just over 70 clubs, work diligently as volunteers to provide, manage, and sustain ATV riding opportunities across the state. I'm here today representing our 14,000 members from across the state of Minnesota, expressing our strong opposition to House File 1012, which threatens the responsible trail development and maintenance that we've worked so hard to establish. I want to speak briefly about the process we've used to establish these, maintain these multiple-use trails. For 37 years, I worked as Department of Natural Resources with Parks and Trails Division. In 1995, I was hired as the department's first off-highway vehicle program manager. At that time, the DNR was working with the state legislature and other land-managing agencies in the state to develop a process for managing OHVs. With your assistance, we created forest classifications, then nearly spent 10 years, several million dollars, and thousands of hours inventorying every state forest, determining the number of forest roads and trails in those forests, which forests should be classified in what classification, which roads and trails should be open, and which ones should be closed. During that time, the DNR also developed a 7-step process for new trail development that must go through before it is funded and can be developed. In conclusion, I ask that the OHC development in Minnesota is very thoughtful and a very regulative activity. For this reason, ATV strongly opposes File 1012. Thank you for your opportunity to speak today.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on my list is Commissioner Rick Gudermont. Please correct my pronunciation of your name.
Spot on. Yes.
Proceed with your testimony.
Okay. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Rick Gudermont, and I am now serving my 34th year as a Lake County Commissioner. I am also speaking on behalf of the Northeastern Regional ATV Joint Powers Board, which includes Lake, St. Louis, and Couchetin counties. Together, we have worked diligently to develop and maintain ATV trails responsibly, ensuring that they support our local economies, enhance outdoor recreation, and protect our natural resources. I am here today to express our strong opposition to House File 1012, which threatens the responsible trail development that we have worked so hard to establish. ATV recreation is a major economic driver in our region, bringing in thousands of riders from across Minnesota to explore the scenic trails of Lake County and beyond. These visitors support our rural communities by spending monies at hotels, restaurants, gas stations, and other local businesses. Businesses that rely heavily on outdoor tourism to survive. But beyond the economic benefits, our counties have made sure that the trail development is done right. The Northeastern Regional ATV Joint Powers Board was formed specifically to ensure responsible and sustainable ATV trail expansion. This board coordinates with the Minnesota DNR, the U.S. Forest Service, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, tribal officials, local ATV clubs, and environmental experts to make sure trails are designed and maintained with erosion control, habitat preservation, and long-term sustainability in mind.
Thank you, Commissioner, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next on my list is Commissioner Ricky Roche, and then after Commissioner Roche will be Karen Umpress. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner. Please get settled. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Ricky Roche. I'm from Cooch County, Cooch County Commissioner. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak today. On the behalf of the County Board, Cooch County Board, I am here to express my strong opposition on the House File 1012, which threatens responsibility, development, maintenance of ATV trails in our county across greater Minnesota. The ATV trails are a lifeline of for our rural economic. In the partnership with Voyager Country ATV, Cooch County has worked to develop and maintain a trail system that boosts tourism, supports local businesses, enhance access to public lands, and for residents and visitors alike. The trails connect communities like International Falls, Little Fork, Big Falls, and surrounding areas, bringing thousands of riders to our local hotels, restaurants, gas stations, small businesses, which many of them rely on the ATV and outdoor tourism to stay afloat. Beyond the economic benefits, our trails develop environmentally stability in mind. Our county follows strict DNR permitted processes, utilizing erosion control measures and conducting regular inspections to ensure responsible trail riding use. Our county forests are already certified and stable, and local ATV clubs and volunteers play an active role in trail maintenance conservative. This bill proposes 300-foot buffer zone and potential decommission of trails would disrupt systems already working, unnecessary limited access for outdoor riders, hunters, and outdoor enthusiasts.
Thank you, Commissioner, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next on my list is Karen Umpress. After Ms. Umpress will be Karen Graham. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Hello, my name is Karen Umfress. I'm with the Amateur Riders Motorcycle Association. We are dirt bike riders and other outdoor enthusiasts. Thanks for allowing me to come here and testify. A couple of years ago, my husband was sitting on West Bush Lake Road, and his car started to shake, similar to, he's from Northern California, a major earthquake. And he looked, and there was a major compact fiber pack system working on putting in the West Lake non-motorized paved trail. This bill is masquerades as common sense and is an actual anti-access, anti-motorized bill. The fact that it doesn't include any non-motorized trails, which the construction of is much severe than any motorized trail construction, included as part of the EQB, EAW requests of 1 mile only, shows the focus of this bill as being anti-motorized. They also have given you a lot of information that can be misleading, mislabeled, such as talking about the border-to-border trail, which is a highway licensed vehicle route that uses cars, trucks, things. And yes, it has bridges that cross trout streams, but it doesn't do any damage to the trout streams, and ATVs are not allowed on that particular route. It also shows you pictures, but it doesn't distinguish between whether those pictures are bear raiders on forest lands or actual trail systems, or if the trail is trail braided or not. So I appreciate you to oppose this particular bill. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on my list is Karen Graham. After Karen will be Terry Snyder. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, members of the committee. I'm Karen Graham, a homeowner at Eagles Nest Township of about 350 homeowners. I speak for House File 1012. This bill provides for motorized recreation while recognizing the needs of people living near or on the trail. Eagles Nest exemplifies the need for this legislation. A local club announced a proposed ATV trail that was already designated the main route on printed and online maps. The board voted no with resolutions in response to local concerns. The club went to the county. Other cities, townships, and tribal governments have similar troubles. This bill brings local governments and OHV organizations together to include local knowledge early in the state or grant and aid process instead of at the end during a general call for public comments. Bike trails in Minnesota are successfully planned with informed communities. The MnDOT manual emphasizes early collaboration to create trails aligned with local values and priorities. Eagles Nest is an example of this engagement in action. The community was informed of a proposed bike trail to get their input. Regular updates and feedback followed in collaboration with the board. Bike and OHV riding are recreational opportunities. House File 1012 adapts the procedures in the state and DNR grant and aid program to include early contact and ongoing collaboration with local governments following the MnDOT process. Thank you for your support.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on my list is Commissioner Terry Snyder. After Commissioner Snyder will be Tim Spreck. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner. Please restate your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Terry Snyder, County Commissioner, Itasca County. A little background, 31 years law enforcement retired and fourth term as County Commissioner. I am here today in opposition to House File 1012. Please reference a letter that was sent by the Itasca County Board. It's in your packet. Itasca County is home to more than 740 miles of snowmobile trails and 390 ATV trails, all of which are connected regionally to all of our neighboring counties. These trails are the central way of life and for our local tourism economy. Itasca County sees an annual tourism revenue of more than $100 million. 1,500 hospitality jobs are created as a result of this, and 6.5 million remitted to the Department of Revenue in sales tax. Itasca County, since 2003, has created a process which is mandatory for all clubs to follow and for trail development that requires permitting with the DNR, MPCA, and obviously any county or local rules that apply. This bill will set back decades of work and put vital tourism and recreational interests at risk. Moreover, the proposed 300-foot buffer restricts the ATV trails near waters and wetlands. It's unnecessary and it's excessive. In place of this bill, Itasca County supports a collaborative, evidence-based approach to trail and land management. That approach must be balanced and accessible with conservation. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on my list is Tim Spreck. After that will be Catherine Neuschler. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Spreck. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, members and Madam Chair. My name is Tim Spreck. I'm speaking today for the Minnesota Trappers Association. According to our analysis, this bill will accomplish the following. It will restrict the use of OHV on trails, routes, and roads. Public land access will be limited. It will drastically increase time and cost to construct and expand new trails and routes. Restricts the use of state, county, and township roads. Removes ability for DNR to allow use by rule. Removes current exceptions and reductions in regulations on trails north of Highway 2, et cetera, et cetera. The reason the trappers are concerned about this bill is because for trappers, it's all about access, mainly access to public lands. Walk-in service to a trap line from a distance road is not practical. When our guys are out running their traps, there's limited number of hours of daylight in the day and they need to get out and get their work done. Trappers have a specific job to do and they're going about it in a conservation-like manner. And I think we have to be very cautious when we lump all users of ATV trails and OHV trails as a guy who maybe had a few too many beers and is out ripping up a wetland. This is not the case. And let's make sure that we're providing the access that these folks need to do their job. Beaver control for nuisance beaver is critically important. They have to be able to get in there to do their work. So with that, Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on my list is Kathleen Neuschler. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Catherine Neuschler. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board. So as noted, this bill does direct the EQB to change our mandatory category rules around recreational trails to cover the construction or expansion of trails for off-highway vehicles. I do expect that that rulemaking will be very complicated due to the relative rarity of categories that require review for any project due to the complexity of the existing rules and due to the interest in this issue that we see here today. So my concern with the initial bill was the short time frame to make those rules, and I want to thank the Representative Purcell for making the change in the author's amendment, which would put us back to the 18-month timeline generally prescribed for legislatively mandated rules. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Last on my list is Laura Prius from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Laura Price. I'm the statewide programs and planning manager for the DNR's Division of Parks and Trails. I'd like to briefly share some information about the existing system. I do have a very brief handout, if it would be okay to share that. DNR has some concerns that are similar to those of the Environmental Quality Board. We look forward to working with the author on those. In sum, the DNR has a comprehensive system for review of trails, as well as looking at our forest classification and trail designation process. I'll briefly share some highlights of those that are in the handout. There's a 7-step process that includes working with local units of government as well as volunteer trails and the DNR working as a 3-part system to develop trails. As part of that process, there's multiple phases of a review, both interdisciplinary, internal, environmental review, as well as public review. It's worth noting that this includes landowner permissions and everyone who's involved in land administration. It also includes a new approach to tribal engagement and tribal consultation. So that's a brief thing that I shared with you on the OHV grant and aid process in some extensive sets of environmental review as well as public engagement. On the second page, we have information about the state forest classification and trail designation system. As you've heard, our state forests are broken into 3 major ones: closed, limited, and managed, with the managed being north of Highway 2. Managed forests have the ability for closed systems. There's a lot of flexibility within that. Changing that would have a large impact in Minnesota and possible unintended consequences. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Great. We will go to member questions, starting with Representative Jacobs.
Thank you, Chair Jordan. So coming from a county background, of course, I heard a couple of county commissioners get up here and express concerns with this. Have you reached out to AMC? Do you have AMC support on your bill?
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe AMC is not supportive of the bill. You know, there's so many different layers of government, so talking with, like, Association of Townships, they are supportive of the bill, so counties may not be, townships are, and then, you know, we also can't make sweeping generalizations. It's not like all counties or all townships are either for or against the bill, but yes, have been working with all those levels of government.
Representative Jacobs.
So you have statewide Township Officers Association support for this?
That was my understanding. Oh, thank you, Madam Chair.
It looks like there is somebody approaching the testifiers table. Please state your name for the record and please try to help us answer this question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Shep Harris. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Townships, and Representative Purcell is correct. The Minnesota Association of Townships does support the bill, especially the local engagement piece. Out of principle and philosophy, they always believe in local control, and they believe, especially in some past experiences, especially dealing with the development of the border-to-border trail, that having an earlier engagement in the planning process would be helpful. Thanks. Thank you.
Representative Jacob, follow-up?
Yeah, so explain to me how, if the state enacts regulations, how does that support local control? It seems like it takes local control away.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this bill is trying to enact some of the pieces that are best management practices that the DNR itself says for this trail development process, which is getting that local control during the process and, in fact, earlier in the process to get that feedback from the locals. So we would be making a state law to put into statute what these recommendations are from the DNR, and that would be to get that local control.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative, for your bill. I have a couple of short, quick questions, and then I have a more elaborate one. But I just want to, we heard a lot of testimony, we heard a lot of stuff, so I just want to make sure that we understand that the amendment took all of the decommissioning trail stuff out of the bill. Is that correct?
Representative Purcell.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Finke, that's correct.
Representative Finke.
Thank you. And then the bill also took out anything that had to do with hunting exemptions or that kind of quote-unquote interference.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Finke. This bill, as written, my understanding and working with this, is it does not remove any of the exemptions for hunting.
Representative Finke.
Okay, so I appreciate that. Thank you, Madam Chair, because it does sometimes get hard to scale to the level of what we're actually talking about in the language versus what we are talking about on a sort of higher level cultural conversation, right? Because this is really a cultural conversation that we're having, not so much is the law here good or bad. Frankly, I don't think that's what we've been talking about. We're trying to make sure that we have various cultures being able to access spaces in a way that is meaningful for them. And the one thing I did want to kind of point to, because what we heard from a few of the, especially from the county officials, was the economic impact of having this sort of different rules that come with accessing these public lands above Highway 2. And economic impact is something that crosses cultures, right? No matter who we are, we want our communities to be thriving. And I understand from the data, and I'm just asking, is this accurate and how does this interact with your work? Far, far more people, to a factor of perhaps seven times, access these communities, public lands, state parks, forests, the places that people want to go. A small portion of the people who visit those use ATVs, and a much larger part of the people who are supporting these local economies do not. Is that accurate?
Representative Purcell, and then we're going to move on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Finke, my understanding is that the number of ATV owners and users in Minnesota, as we talked about on the last ATV day, is fairly limited, especially compared to Minnesotans who hike or camp or bike or birdwatch, et cetera. And I think it's looking at all of those economic impacts that we heard from the counties, which is really important. I used to live in Lake County. I used to live in Cook County and Cass County, and like that is an important part of the economy. And also, this is the Environment Committee, and so we can look at that statistic. And also, why is it that Minnesotans love up north? It's because of the environmental integrity and quality that's there. And so trying to strike a balance between both of those things is the hope.
I have Representative Burkle, Representative Gilman, and Representative Heintzman. We'll go to Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Purcell, thank you for the amendment. Appreciate taking out the decommissioning section. But I do have a question about Section 1, if I'm understanding correctly as I read it. I'm curious about the language surrounding the Commissioner of Agriculture or a county containing the noxious weed section. Do you know where I'm at? Be 2.8, 2.9. I'm assuming that's still in the bill. That's not in the amendment. Do you have any sense, or maybe there's someone with the Department of Ag could explain or answer the question about how many counties that would entail with noxious weeds? I'm curious.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would love to phone a friend if anyone can.
I would too.
Answer Co-Vice Chair Burkle's question about lines 2.8 through 2.10.
Okay, let's put a pin in that. While somebody approaches, we'll go to Representative Gilman, and then we'll come back to Representative Burkle. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. So just a few weeks ago, we had ATV hearings as well. And Ramsey County, I heard, had the most registrations for ATVs. Did you know that to be true?
Representative Purcell?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe it's Hennepin County.
Hennepin? Okay.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you so much. Again, so I just think about Minnesota, about having fun, about getting together, creating community, and making memories. And so I just want to know, like, with private citizens traveling, we talk about the economic impact and just how hard things have been to recover from just what happened just a few years ago with things being shut down. I just want to know, will you engage more with folks that are opposed to this, knowing that their livelihood could be impacted, you know, if this bill were to become law?
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Gilman, for that. This is a public invitation to people in the room, people who might be listening, would love to engage further. And in fact, I think, you know, hearing testimony from 16 folks, fairly evenly split, I think that shows that there is a lot more work and conversation to do on this. And I'm happy to engage in that.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. My understanding is the bill is being laid over, so hopefully we can answer Representative Burkle's question, maybe offline since no one's approaching, and then we can continue to work on it. But I'll go to Representative Heintzman to close.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Members, this bill has zero bipartisan support in either chamber, at least at the moment. I was checking. And just based on the testimony from those that in many cases traveled quite a distance to get here and from agencies, I think they would concur, Representative Purcell, with your just moments ago assessment that there is a lot of work that needs to be done on this if it ever was to have bipartisan support, which I'm not entirely sure that we have the time to do that, but I hope that there is. One of the comments that was concerning that I hope can change is in testimony today, we heard someone say that this is an anti-ATV bill, and that is the perception that that's the current state of the bill. And as Representative Gilman was just saying, ATVs travel to greater Minnesota from metro communities, and it's a heck of a job, and the folks in this room, a lot of them with the shirts on, are probably trail ambassadors, those that are out there trying to make sure that our trails are safe and that signage is protected. And these people care about our ATV systems. They spend countless hours policing themselves, training operators, working with kids. And they're the reason that we have the trail systems that we do currently have in Minnesota. When they come in numbers like this and show up and are passionate about their opposition to this bill, I hope that members are paying attention. Nothing further.
Thank you, Representative Co-Chair Heinzman. Representative Purcell, please briefly close out your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank all the Minnesotans who provided testimony, written or in committee, to my colleagues for such an interesting and important discussion on the topic. The quote, the placement of any trail on the landscape has an ecological impact. The challenge is to keep those impacts to a minimum while providing the desired trail experience. All trails should be conceived as low-impact recreational experiences with a built footprint only as needed. This is from the DNR's own guidelines, along with their 7 guiding principles for sustainable trails. I have been honored to work alongside dedicated Minnesota residents, working on a volunteer basis, because this is a very passionate issue for so many of us. And we have seen these concerns be exacerbated more in recent years, and I plan to continue working on this next biennium and beyond, and so I welcome the conversation and promise to dedicate myself to that dialogue with stakeholders who want to discuss this sort of legislation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Vice Chair Purcell renews her motion that House File 1012 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion and discussion in a future bill. The bill is laid over, and members, we are adjourned.